Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 72 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
What's happening, man? How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, I am too. I'm good.
We are back and better than ever.
Gibby's back.
Gibby's back. Back again.
Yeah. I'm feeling pretty good, man.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that you're on the mend.
Yeah. Still get some pain, but you know.
Well, you know, I knew you were going to milk it for as long as you could.
But I know.
We'll see how long it goes.
For a couple more weeks, you know. Doctor did say 6 weeks.
And you did say you'd be doing cardio in a day.
So yeah, well, I know.
I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah. I'm getting, you know, to that point, though, you know.
Where you're about ready to do some cardio? You're thinking about I think about doing cardio all the time.
I'm lacing up, man.
Are you?
Yeah.
I think about lacing up. I don't actually lace up.
Yeah, you don't even have shoes that lace.
No.
So, I mean, just to be
honest. Makes it tougher.
Yeah.
All right, Gibbs, we have some new Patreon supporters.
Oh, cool.
So let's give some shout outs. We had Sherry Riley jumped out to her highest level.
Thank you.
Jason Lee Smith.
Hey, JLS.
Jessica Britton.
Jessica Britton, thank you.
Melinda Valradian.
Yeah, Melinda.
Carrie Palmer.
Yeah.
Dana Scarpula.
Dana.
Q Mario accent.
Because you think I was going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
I know. I thought you were for sure. I'm going to hold back. We had Jared Foster.
Hey, Jared.
Sandy Moss. Jacob Hughes.
Jacob.
Mary Petrowski jumped out at her highest level.
Hey, thanks, Mary.
Mandy Hudson. Charlotte Grissom. And we had Doug Niemeyer.
Doug Niemeyer. Niemeyer.
Is that ringing a bell for you?
That's like Animal House. Remember Niemeyer?
Yeah, was he the guy that was dressed in the ROTC uniform?
Oh, wasn't that?
It was Niedermeyer, wasn't it?
Niedermeyer, that's it. But I know that's not Doug. I know Doug.
We know Doug.
Yeah.
So Doug turned 60 last week. His daughters were amazing. Got him some...
Those gals,
as you call them. Got him some TCAT mugs. Left the voicemail. We did the shout out, and Doug said, "You know what? I gotta support the boys. I gotta get on Patreon like my daughters, and we appreciate that."
Yeah.
If we go back into the vault, Gibbs. This week we selected Joe Farrar.
All right.
Been with us on the TCAT bandwagon for quite a while.
He has, man.
Big supporter, big social media guy.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Always
appreciate that,
pumping
Joe.
Us up on Facebook especially. So big shout out to Joe. Big thanks to the new Patreon supporters. And a huge thanks to all those people that continue to support us month after month. It really helps us to keep putting out these podcasts.
And if you're not sure, do it anyway.
That's kind of your motto in life, isn't it?
If you're not sure, just go ahead and take a dip and move forward.
All right. Take a dip. Take all your clothes off. Jump right in.
Just dive in, man.
That's Gibby's motto.
Just dive in.
All right. We had some PayPal support as well.
Okay.
So I definitely want to give shout outs to Slats McCracker.
Well, Slats, thank you very much.
One of these days, we're going to get like a Phil McCracken.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like
that. That'd be great.
Jennifer Glassford.
Okay.
Kelly Holiday.
Yeah.
Joanne Paventa.
Paventa.
And Karen Seifker.
Seeker?
Seifker.
Oh, Seifker.
Yeah.
Seifker.
And I'm probably not saying it right, but
yeah,
doing my best.
Is it like Norwegian?
It might be.
Okay.
I know you're fascinated by the names and trying to match them up where people are from.
Absolutely. I want to know the origin of the name and the people.
I'm surprised you don't have like a really good Scandinavian, Swedish, Norwegian accent yet.
You know, and with all the Swedes and
Norwegians. And I was wondering how, I thought it'd help you out there. I didn't know how Finns, that was going to come out.
You know?
The Finns. Let's not leave out the Finns.
Yeah, don't leave the Finns out. We got it. We got some, what do you call it? Is that the Icelandic?
Icelandic?
Icelandic region?
I think no. Iceland's its own place.
Oh, yeah.
It?
It's late in the evening, folks. Scandinavian, yeah.
I just assume that if you had one, it would come out as like the Swedish cook from the Muppets.
I I think I need to head there and see this place.
I think we would have a blast.
Yeah. Got to know when summertime is there, though. I don't want to go when it's...
I don't know if there is one.
I mean...
I'm just kidding.
The warmest?
What's the warmest time of the year?
What's the warmest time of the year there?
It would be a lot of fun.
It would be.
Because I've always been really fascinated by those Scandinavian countries. They just have this kind of aura, like everything. Now, they get their share of crime, and they love their true crime. There's no doubt about that.
But if you think that my French accent was good,
mm-hmm. I did not.
Oh. Well, you got to hear my Scandinavian accent.
You're really lumping it all in.
I am.
It's not just Swedish. It's not
Scandinavian
Finnish.
Now.
It's just you have an accent that covers all of Scandinavia.
Yeah, actually, just Europe in general.
Just the European.
Yeah.
We call it British, but.
Yeah. Or anything outside the U.S., just it's that language.
It's British.
Yeah.
So at the time that this episode's out, don't forget the TCAT episode out at the same time. We're talking about Keith Hunter Jesperson, long-haul trucker killer. And you know I've got a deep fascination with these...
Truckers
that crisscross the country, selecting victims that they have no connection with. And there's a lot of them out there. I think Keith Jesperson and the crimes that he committed, they're some of the worst. So definitely check that out. We have to give a huge shout out to Lindsay Scalaric.
We do.
For her writing and research on this episode.
Yeah, thanks, Lindsay.
She's been giving us so much help recently. It's unbelievable. All right, Gibbs, you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's get into a little Unsolved.
Let's do it.
We are talking about a Polaroid picture.
Yeah.
We named the episode The Polaroid Picture.
Just shake it like a Polaroid picture.
Or picture.
Or that too.
Either one. I knew this was going to be one of those episodes because the word picture is in the episode.
I have no problem saying picture.
I don't have a problem with you saying it either.
Sounds good.
We're starting June 15th, 1989.
Okay.
Because on this date, a Polaroid picture was found in Port St. Joe, Florida. And in this picture, there are two children, one girl, one boy. The girl appears to be older than the boy. They both have black duct tape over their mouths. You can't see their hands or feet, but by looking at the picture, you would have to assume that they are bound, probably with their hands and feet, hands behind the back, I would think, Gibbs.
Yeah.
Feet, maybe just either outside of the picture or, but they definitely look like they are bound. In the picture, the boy looks very concerned. The girl, who we said's older, she looks older. She has this look of, Gibbs, contempt, maybe even like hatred on her face.
She does.
Now, if she's bound and duct taped, with duct tape over her mouth, that would be the right look to have. The picture was found in a parking lot of a junior food convenience store. Now, it was a woman that found the photograph. She pulled into a parking lot at the convenience store. And when she got out of her car, she noticed that parked next to her was a white cargo van. She entered the store. She did whatever she was there to do, shop, pick up whatever. As she's leaving the store, she sees this white van leaving, and she would say that this was a 1980-something Toyota cargo van. It was driven by a man with a mustache that she thought appeared to be in his 30s. As she's getting back to her car, this is when she finds the Polaroid, and she's not 100% sure that it was dropped from that van that she had just seen leaving, but she believed that it was. But you have to imagine, Gibbs, what is going through this woman's mind when she finds this Polaroid picture of these two young people that appear to be bound. I mean, that would set off some alarm bells in anyone.
Absolutely.
And it does in her. She calls the police, and the police take this very seriously after seeing the picture. I mean, they set up roadblocks right away to try to catch this van that the woman described, but they're not successful, right? These roadblocks are not successful in catching the van, but they start to investigate this picture. And one of the things that they do is they reach out to people at Polaroid and they learn that the photograph had to have been taken during or after May of 1989. And the reason for this is because the film that was used to make the picture was only available after that period of time. So it must have come out, you know, in May of 1989.
Well, that makes sense, right? You can take the picture and analyze it and determine what stock your, you know, the manufacturers track all this with this different, what's the identification number they used? I'm going to say SKU, but it's not a SKU.
It's not a SKU or a SKU.
No.
You just called it a SKU.
Did I just call it a SKU? You did
the second time.
Yeah.
Well, I would think if you worked at Polaroid,
yeah,
you could probably just look at it and say, look at the back of it and say, you know, this came out.
Based on that 4-digit, 5-digit, whatever number on the back, this is when it was manufactured.
Well, because we're also talking about, this is a month later.
Yeah.
We're not talking about 10, you know, this picture was taken 10 years ago. The picture was found in the middle of June, 1989. This type of film just came out the month before.
You know, they still make Polaroid, by the way.
They do. My daughters both have. It's kind of back in vogue or whatever term you want to use.
To the point, we were at CrimeCon. I just remembered as we were trying to make our way to exit and come back home, some really great listeners grabbed us.
They did.
And asked for some pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it Polaroid style.
Yep. And they had a nice one. It looked like a nice Polaroid camera. All right, so let's talk about the picture. It looks like the two kids are inside of some type of white van. Now, it appears to be windowless or maybe a camper. I don't know, Gibbs. It looks like a white van with the door slid open to me.
Yeah, I agree.
Because on the left side of the picture, you can see what appears to be a door. There's a book in the photograph lying next to the girl. You can make it out. It's a paperback copy of a V.C. Andrews book named My Sweet Adrena. Now, experts say there's a phone number written on the spine of the book, but some of the digits are unreadable. It's said that there are 300 possible phone numbers that it could be. 57 of them are actual valid phone numbers. The girl in the photograph is wearing a gray t-shirt and has some type of block lettering on the front. The wording is not clear, but some people have thought that it could be an Egghead software t-shirt. She's also wearing black softie or athletic type shorts. And I remember Egghead Software, Gibbs. You know, they had brick and mortar stores. They sold computer software from 1984 to 1998. They had about 200 stores, most of them on the West Coast. After the picture was discovered, it was shown by law enforcement to managers at Egghead, and they were asked if they recognized either of the two in the photo, but nobody recognized either one of these kids. Now, the boy is wearing a light blue t-shirt with a black cartoon dog on the left front of the t-shirt, and you can't see his legs at all. There's a clear plastic disposable cup under the girl's legs. I don't know if it's directly under her, Gibbs, or if it's more between her and the boy, but her legs are bent.
Yeah.
Up and then
I think come back down. How pictures are, one way you look at it, you might see it that way, but, you know, angles and
yeah, it looks like it could be more between them, but it also looks like it's closer to her, so it's kind of hard to tell. There's a piece of duct tape laying in front of the boy's chest, and it's kind of bent in half, but the sticky side of the tape is definitely up. There's some sort of duffel bag or sports bag in the back of the photo, and a white plastic bin with some type of fabric or clothing inside. The black duct tape on the girl's mouth, you can see the light reflecting off of it. And you can actually see the outline of her lips. And I think that just tells you that this duct tape was pressed very tightly. Both of the kids are laying on pillows. One is white and one is striped with light blue and white. And they're also laying on blankets. You know, one blanket is white with pink and yellow gold flowers or some type of design. And I mentioned, Gibbs, the girl has her feet almost, you can't see her actual feet, but her legs are propped up.
Yeah, you can kind of look at the photo and it looks like she's sitting on her hands because I can kind of see a little bit of her, like part of her hand, right? Just coming out underneath her, where she's sitting on them.
Yeah, to me, Gibbs, it looks like her thumb and her index finger of her left hand. But the object that her feet, or the, you know, the bottoms of her leg and her feet are elevated, and this thing that they're resting on, it has, it looks like it's light blue, and it almost has this pattern that you would see, makes me think it's a mattress from the looks of it.
Yeah, it's got that diamond shape.
Yeah, it when you see it, it looks like the side of a mattress. Now, neither the girl nor the boy visually, by looking at them, seem to be injured in any way, but the girl has what appears to be a scar on her right calf. They both look reasonably healthy, despite the situation that they appear to be in. And they don't look to be malnourished or anything at this point. But that is the picture. That's what investigators had to go on. That's all they had to go on. That's all that we have to go on. All right, Gibbs, let's take a quick minute to talk about our sponsor, Quip. Now, everyone knows when you walk down the toothbrush aisle, there are a lot of options. And a lot of those options are gimmicks. And that's because a lot of brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing. But not Quip. You know, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, but still packs in just the right amount of vibrations to clean your teeth effectively. Has a built-in timer getting you to that dentist recommended 2 minutes, but it also gives you a little pulse that tells you when it's time to switch sides. Quip subscription plans deliver new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, and that includes free shipping worldwide. They've been on Oprah's O-List, Time's Best Inventions, and it's the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. And I've been blown away by this Quip toothbrush. I like the way it handles. And for me, a big thing about toothbrushes are the bristles. And I think this is an area where it shines. You will not be disappointed. So you can get started today for just $25 by going to getquip.com/unsolved. And you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/unsolved. Let me spell it out. getquip.com/unsolved. Now, there are a lot of theories about this picture.
Some more prominent than others.
Yeah, some very prominent. Now, the first theory is about who this boy could be. And a lot of people in the beginning, early on, believed that he was a missing 9-year-old boy named Michael Henley. Michael Henley had gone missing while on a camping trip with his father and a family friend on April 21st, 1988. But after just 20 minutes of them being on this camping trip after they arrived, Michael disappeared. Now, his dad believed he had wandered off and got lost. but there were searches of the area. They didn't find any traces of him. After the Polaroid was found, the Henley family believed it was Michael in the picture. But then in June of 1990, Michael's remains were found just a few miles from the campsite that he disappeared from. They identified his remains using dental records, and the cause of death was believed to be hypothermia. They ruled out foul play. So it does sound like, Gibbs, that what his father believed was probably true.
Yeah.
You know, he got lost. He couldn't figure out where he was. They couldn't find him.
Right.
And he died from exposure to the elements.
I think people really underestimate the power of the forest, man. I mean, it doesn't take much to, you know, heavy woods forest to get lost and, you know.
That's true. Did you said the forest.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you said the force.
Let the force be with you?
No, I thought you said the power of the force first. Yeah. But then I realized you were saying forest.
Yeah, it's just my...
No, I believe you. I think people underestimate Mother Nature in general. You know, they get out into some place doing something that they think is going to be fun. One thing doesn't go your way, and you're not prepared to brave the elements for an extended period of time.
If you can't see, you know, a horizon, a fixed subject, you know, something fixed in your vision that you can determine direction, it's hard for, you know, the human mind to understand, you know, what direction they're going in. You've got to be able to have a fixed object or horizon or something to look at.
So it's sad, very sad what happened to Michael Henley. But once they figured this out, you know, kind of ruled him out being the boy in the photograph. But still to this day, Gibbs, there are some people that believe that it could have been him. But I don't know how it could have been. You know, would somebody take this boy from the campsite, somehow have him, let's say, in this van, and then later on take him back to the campsite for him to die? That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
No.
I think it pretty much rules him out in my mind.
Yeah, I think so too.
And then we get to Tara Calico. And Tara Calico went missing. She was 19 years old on September 20th, 1988. And this is when you say prominent missing people, Tara Calico fits into that category. You know, there have been whole podcasts done on Tara Calico. You know, we interacted with the woman that did that podcast on her when we were at CrimeCon last year.
We certainly did.
Tara Calico was riding her bike. She was listening to a cassette tape of the band Boston on her Walkman. She left at about 9:30 in the morning, and she planned to ride 17 miles before making it back home, and she was going to meet her boyfriend for tennis at noon. So that's a heck of a bike ride.
That's more than a heck of a bike ride for you, man. That's a marathon.
For me, to some people, that's just a Saturday morning. And apparently, before she left, she jokingly said to her mother, "If you don't hear from me by noon, come look for me." And when Tara didn't return, her mother did go looking for her.
What a nightmare, though. I know, you know, we'll probably eventually cover this story, but
in more detail.
More detail,
sure.
But think of that as a parent, you know? One of the last things your kid says is in joking around, and then it actually turns into be something real that you have to deal with.
So her mom, in looking for her, she doesn't find Tara, but what she finds is the cassette, the Boston cassette, on the side of the road. And at that point, she would be extremely worried. I mean, she's already worried. But finding something that she knew Tara probably wouldn't have left behind, that would send you into overdrive, I would think.
Yeah, of course it would.
She immediately called the police. They began a search, and they end up finding the broken Walkman and her bike thrown into a ditch. And at that point, things would be very serious because you know at that point something is very wrong. Police took this case very seriously. And then the photo was found about a year later, 1,600 miles away from where she went missing in New Mexico. When Tara's mother saw the photo, she was convinced that the girl in the picture was her daughter. Number one, she thought it looked like her. And then she saw what we talked about. We said it appears to be a scar on her right leg. And Tara's mother said that she had a scar in that same spot. And then you talk about the book, My Sweet Adrena by V.C. Andrews. That was Tara Calico's favorite author. Now, that was also a very popular author back during that time period. A lot of people were reading V.C. Andrews. Now, as you can imagine, this photograph has been analyzed by a lot of different people, a lot of different agencies with unbelievable cutting-edge technology. So Scotland Yard, the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and the FBI, just to name a few. But those are some outfits, Gibbs, that have state-of-the-art technology.
Yeah.
Scotland Yard came to the conclusion that it was Tara. They believed it was Tara. The Los Alamos National Laboratory came to the conclusion that it was not Tara. And the FBI said it was inconclusive. So basically, three different agencies came up with three different conclusions. So that didn't help. Didn't lead to any more answers for the Calico family.
No, no clarity there.
But this is not the only photograph to surface that people believe to be of Tara Calico. There have been two others that have popped up over the years. The first was found near a construction site in Montecito, California. And it's a blurry photograph of a girl's face with tape covering her mouth and striped blue fabric behind her, which is said to be very similar to the pillow in this Polaroid picture that we're talking about. And this picture was taken using film that was not available until June of 1989. The second picture shows a woman loosely bound in what appears to be gauze or some type of toilet paper. She's on a bus with a man. She has on black framed glasses and she's in a very awkward position. The man has his mouth open in the picture. He's lightly holding her, but he has this look on his face of almost amusement. There's a fold down tray in front of them with a Sprite, sunglasses, maybe some type of wallet or change purse sitting on it. But the film used for this picture was determined to not have been available until February of 1990. And Tara's mother believed that this first picture of the two was also Tara, but not the second. She thought the second was taken as some type of gag or prank or something like that. And apparently, the Calico family, Gibbs, they've looked at many, many pictures. And these are the only three that have not been ruled out. And you can find the second two pictures that we're talking about online. They're a little more difficult. They're a little bit harder to find than the Polaroid picture. That's out there everywhere. But you can find them. Now, 20 years after Tara's disappearance, Rene Rivera, the sheriff of Valencia County, claimed to know what happened to Tara. He says that boys who knew Tara drove up behind her, and then some kind of accident happened while she was on the bike. And he believes that she later died and that the boys decided to cover it up. He goes on to say that he knows the names of the boys that he believes are involved, but because they've never found Tara's body, he doesn't have enough evidence to convict anyone. Now, there's also really no evidence, Gibbs, that's come out to back up this claim or this theory. On September 16th, 1987, 28-year-old Julie Weflin, an operator at Bonneville Power Administration in Spokane, Washington, disappeared. Part of her job at the time was to work at power substations, which were usually in remote locations. On that day, she was at a Spring Hill substation checking on a low nitrogen report. Her coworker told her to let it go for the day, but she insisted on checking this out. She checked into the station at 2 p.m., but around 3:30 p.m., she had gone missing. When they found her truck, the driver's side door and the back hatch were open. Her purse was found in the truck, and a water bottle and a pair of sunglasses were found on the ground near the truck. At the time, law enforcement thought that she had been overpowered by two people, and they based this on the gravel, which showed signs of a struggle and what they thought was a drag mark. There were fresh tire patterns found near the substation, and they didn't match Julie's truck. Originally, her husband was a prime suspect, even though he was over 50 miles away painting a house at the time.
Yeah, 50 miles away is not very far.
No, it's not. I mean, you can get 50 miles in usually an hour or less, depending on the location. But many people believe that this Port St. Joe Polaroid that we're talking about bears more of a resemblance to Julie Weflin than it does Tara Calico. But the argument is also made that the girl in the picture is much younger than 28. And keep in mind, 28 is how old Julie was when she went missing. She would have been 30 at the time that the Polaroid was actually found. But she was only 5'2". She weighed 110 pounds, and some people think that she looked much younger than what she actually was. But to this day, Gibbs, her body has never been found, which obviously she's never been found, but Right. Neither has her body.
Right.
Another theory is that the girl in the photo is Lori Erica Ruff. Originally, Lori was Kimberly McLean from the Philadelphia area. She moved away from her Wincote home in the fall of 1986. And then essentially, Gibbs, her family never heard from her again. Within the next 2 years, she obtained a birth certificate of someone named Becky Sue Turner, who died in a fire in Fife, Washington at the age of 2 in 1971. She used the certificate to get an Idaho ID card, and then later moved to Texas and changed her name to Lori Erica Kennedy. So she stole the identity of a deceased 2-year-old that had died 15, 16, 17 years earlier. But she kept this name, Lori Erica Kennedy, and she acquired a Social Security card. And she even went on to graduate college. She later got married. And it's at that point that she became Lori Erica Ruff. But Lori was very odd about her past. She wouldn't talk about it. And we know why she wouldn't talk about it, but her in-laws didn't know, and they thought she was standoffish, and they didn't really take to her. In 2010, she committed suicide. And after her death, it was found out that she had stolen these identities. But it wasn't until 2016, using DNA from her daughter, that they found out who she really was, Kimberly McLean. And it was said that after her funeral, some members of the Ruff family drove to Lori's house, because at the time of her death, she was separated from her husband. They wanted to see if they could find out more about her. And imagine that, Gibbs. I mean, your own wife, your daughter-in-law, you find out that you didn't really know who they were.
Yeah. How bizarre would that be, man, that this whole time it was somebody else on paper?
Yeah. I mean, they knew who she was, but they didn't know who she used to be, I guess is how I would put it. Would be very strange, though. So when they enter her home, the house is a mess. I mean, it was said, like, this is something you would see on an episode of Hoarders. This is how bad of a shape this house was in. There were piles of trash, all kinds of shredded documents, papers with, you know, scribbling on them that didn't make any sense. They eventually found a lockbox in her closet, and they were able to pry it open. Inside the box, they discovered Lori was not who she said she was. They found all the documentation of her past, but Lori had left some suicide notes, but they were essentially incoherent ramblings. They also found Becky Sue Turner's birth certificate and a judge's ruling allowing a name change from Becky Sue Turner to Lori Erica Kennedy. When they looked up Becky Sue Turner, they discovered that she had died at the age of 2. They found some random notes that said North Hollywood Police, 402 months, and Ben Perkins. And Ben Perkins turned out to be an attorney. So people have speculated that these notes indicated that she was looking at possible jail time or was in trouble or she thought she was about to be. When the attorney Ben Perkins was asked, he had no recollection of her or any information about her in his database. But there are many people, Gibbs, that think she looked very similar to the girl in the Polaroid. Remember, the Polaroid was taken in 1989. This is the same year that Lori got her Texas driver's license. In 2009, a photo of a young boy was sent to Port St. Joe police and media, and this rekindled interest in the original Polaroid. This photo is of a young boy that resembles the boy in the original Polaroid. There is a black marker drawn across his mouth and face as if to resemble tape across his mouth. The Gulf County Sheriff Joe Nugent was a deputy when the original photograph was found, and he made a statement that said, "I think we are just dumbfounded. It is kind of weird these photos came in near the anniversary of the original case. But if someone is trying to send us a clue, send us one we can act on." Nugent believes that because the children in the original photograph look scared, there's no way that that photograph is a hoax. And I would agree with that, especially the boy. The boy looks very frightened.
He does. He really does, man.
Now, the police chief of Port St. Joe, guy by the name of David Barnes, he received two letters. One was postmarked June 10th and the other August 10th, both from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And both Michael Henley and Tara Calico were reported missing in New Mexico. One of these letters contained a photograph printed on copy paper, and it's of a young blonde boy with a black band drawn over his mouth. The second letter contained an original image of the boy. On August 12th, the Star newspaper received a third letter. This was also postmarked from Albuquerque on August 10th, and it contained the same photo of the boy with his mouth marked. None of the letters contained a return address or any type of note indicating the child's identity. Sheriff Nugent said investigators had very recently been looking into the case again, so when the letters arrived, they immediately thought of the Polaroid. They cannot determine if the new pictures are of the same boy or not, But Nugent believes that the fact that they came from New Mexico and arrived around the time of the anniversary is more than a coincidence. There was also a call received by authorities on the same day that the Star turned over its letter to the sheriff's office. A woman called claiming she had been having visions of the case for years and that she believed Tara Calico was buried in California. The woman also claimed that she had worked with a runaway in a strip club in California and that the runaway was later reported murdered and buried. She described seeing a light blue Oldsmobile car and the name of Tara Calico in a vivid dream that she's had for many years. So it sounds like she keeps having the same dream. The California authorities are dismissive of the case, but Nugent believes the timing of the call just adds to the oddness of everything. The letters were sent to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Lab in Pensacola to be tested for fingerprints and DNA, but there's really been no further update on the letters from 2009 and no new developments.
Clearly, this is a very popular photo with a lot of people on social media. It's gained a lot of attention. It's tied in a lot, like we mentioned, to Tara. However, there's no conclusion of who it actually is. And
well, I think it's popular because of the mystery. I mean, sure. It's a very mysterious photograph.
And I don't think back then that this, and I believe the sheriff, this is a real photo, right? I think somebody today would do something like this for a hoax. Today, with technology, I think somebody would go out and make something like this and see if they could, rouse up some publicity just to get notoriety out of something, I mean, just to come out later and say, oh, it was a hoax. I just wanted to see how many people would buy into it. This one, though, back at that time frame, I think that's 100% real. I think looking at that boy's face, there's fear. Looking at her face, there's concern and so I think she's frightened as well.
I think she's frightened. I think she's also disgusted.
Yeah.
She's upset. She's like shooting daggers at whoever I think is taking the photograph.
Yeah, it's alarming.
I do agree with you, though. My personal feeling is that the photograph is real, which is scary.
Yeah.
Because that means that most likely something very bad happened to the two kids that were in the photograph. I also think you're right about today with social media and, somebody would play around with something like that. But there was no social media back then.
Nope.
There was nobody to send that photograph to.
No.
Like there would be today. I don't see what anybody would get out of creating that situation and that photograph.
And knowing that, this is not like whoever this person was. They didn't mail that photo off to somebody to be, looked at. It sounds like, and we don't know, but it sounds like it fell out of that person's vehicle or off their person that their attention was never to leave it behind in the parking lot. But then again, maybe it could have been. Maybe they thought, I'm going to drop this here. Someone finds it. Who knows what will happen? But I'm willing to take that risk.
Yeah. So a couple things that just popped into my head, Gibbs. So if it was a hoax, you would think somebody would have discovered by now who was in that photograph.
Because yes.
If it was a hoax, those people were still alive.
Right.
But the other thing is what I find hard to believe. So let's say it's not Tara Calico. It's not Laura, Erica, Kennedy,
right?
Or all the names, different names that she had, Kimberly McLean, and it's none of these people that we've talked about,
right?
I just can't believe that nobody has been able to identify these two people, these two kids who had to have gone missing.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't believe nobody's come forward and said. Now, Tara's mom's come forward and said she thinks it's her.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
And it very well could be.
Sure.
It does
resemble.
resemble, bear a striking resemblance to Terra Calico.
Yep. Yeah, I think you can definitely, if you had to lean to a position, I think that's the position you would lean towards.
But what shocks me about that is that you, with all the technology of all the agencies out there, and like you said, the FBI couldn't conclusively say whether it was her or not.
But Scotland Yard could, so.
They did, yep.
Who was the better?
But then you had the one agency that said, no, it wasn't.
Yeah.
You would think with facial recognition and all this technology.
Today.
Somebody would be able today to say conclusively, yay or nay.
Right. Yeah.
So, but that's it. That is the story of the Polaroid picture. It is one of those fascinating mysteries because, number one, you don't know who these people are for sure. And number two, you don't know what happened to them. And you don't know who was involved with what happened to them. So there's like a whole bunch of different mysteries here.
Yeah.
That we just don't know.
Plenty of rabbit holes.
All right, Gibbs, we've got some voicemails. You want to do those?
Yes.
Hi, this is Colleen Hartshorn from Lewiston, Idaho. I'm the one who suggested the Elsie Valley serial killer. And I want to thank you again for doing it. I'm hoping that it brings new tips. They've actually reopened some of the cases. I am calling to give you another suggestion. When I was a freshman at Eastern Washington University way back in 1979, up in Cheney, Washington, we had the South Hill rapist operating in Spokane, Kevin Coe, and he was subsequently arrested. But what's interesting about this case is that his mother was also arrested for trying to hire a hitman to kill not only the judge, but the prosecutor. So, go Team Ferg, go Team Gibby. Keep your own time ticking. Thanks, bye.
All right, love that voicemail. So, I played it on Unsolved because she talked about Elsie Valley. But then, you know, at the end, she's talking about some cases that are solved. I just had to pick one. I went with Unsolved. But we'll definitely look into that. I've heard of that name before.
Yeah, it sounds intriguing.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Gibby. This is Leslie, a.k.a. Mrs. Northman on Twitter. I'm from South Dakota. I just wanted to call and say hi. I listen to you guys at work. I work 12-hour days, so between calls, I've been listening to you. I'm currently on episode 50 of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. And pretty soon, then, I will be switching over to the whole day True Crime All the Time. I wanted to thank you for everything. Helps me get through the day. Love listening to you guys. And I'm hoping that Mike can get a Gibby Gal shirt in the merch area so I can order one of those. But I wanted to thank you again, and both of you keep your own time ticking. Have a good day. Bye.
All right, Gibbs. Not the first request I've gotten for Gibby merchandise.
Gibby merchandise.
We just got to figure out what to put in there, man.
Gibby Gal. Gibby Gals?
You can't. I think you said Gibby Gal.
Gibby Gal. Gibby Gal. Gibby Gal.
Maybe I'll do the typing on what goes on the shirt.
Yeah. We did have a nice shirt that Joan did.
That was a cool shirt.
Yeah, that was great, man. She pulled that off. So, but I don't think I've seen anything since then. No other Gibby shirts.
Well, no, we can put whatever we want on the merch thing.
Yeah.
I just need your input since
it's got a Gibby mug.
Technically going to have your name on it.
Hey, Gibby and Fergie, it's Cam here. How you go, mate? That's how it is. Great show, and I thought Gibby's accent was very funny. I don't know if it's Indian or what, but it's definitely not Aussie. So how you go, mate? That's how you do it. Cheers, guys.
How you doing, mate?
That actually wasn't too bad.
That's how you do it.
So that was Cambo Ford.
Yeah, great podcast.
True Crime Island. If you haven't checked it out, we highly recommend it, and we love Cambo. The guy is just super cool.
Just bring your deck chair.
Got to bring your deck chair. And so the fact that he was listening to the episode cracks me up.
Yeah.
To hear your accent.
He's our buddy, man.
No, he is. He's a very, very cool guy and does a great podcast. We can't recommend it enough.
Hi, guys. This is Marie calling from Bergen, Norway. And I wish I had more of a Norwegian accent in English, but this is kind of what happens when you live on Cape Cod for 2 years. Maybe give it a try, the accent instead. I actually think that would be kind of hilarious. I wanted to say that I love you guys' podcast. I started by listening to Teacat Unsolved, but then I started with Teacat True Crime All the Time, and I just have to say I love them both. You guys make my commute to and from downtown Bergen, where I first went to school and now I work here, of 30 minutes, much more enjoyable. Just wanted to lastly give a shout out to also the TCAT fan group. They're so, just being so fun and such open spaces for true friend fans, as well as people sharing things from their everyday life. And I think it's just very fun. Anyways, just wanted to tell you guys this, and thanks for making the podcast, and it's really fun, and keep your own time ticking. Bye.
Norway.
Didn't sound, I mean, she sounded to me like she could have been from Ohio. She mentioned Cape Cod. She spent time at Cape Cod.
Yeah. So, Norway.
Now, her cell phone sounded like it was from Norway.
Yeah.
Like she was calling from Norway. But yeah, you know what's strange, and I meant to say this, Gibbs, had a lot of voicemails over the last couple weeks that didn't come through very well.
Oh,
like yeah? There might have been something wrong on our end
with that Google number.
Yeah, with the software.
Yeah, just by the way, back to Norway. I am somewhat Norwegian because in the sixth grade we had to pick a country for our sixth grade Olympics who we would represent out on field day, and I was one of the ones that was Norwegian from Norway.
Norwegian from Norway.
Yeah. I think we ran away with some medals.
I'm sure you did. Yeah. Knowing the type of athlete that you were.
I got my husky butt out there, man, and we pulled off some miracles.
He's running so fast his huskies came
that's
off.
That's right. Huskies. They were boom, boom,
he just
gone.
Shredded those huskies.
Just shredded those bad boys, man.
Oh.
Hey, Mike, hey, Gibby. This is Linda from Topeka, Kansas, and I have listened to every episode you have probably at least twice. I process applications for the Topeka Medicaid for the elderly and disabled, so we are allowed to listen to our podcasts and music all day. So for 8 hours, I enjoy listening to you guys explain these. Unfortunately, they're so horrific, but the fact that you're able to do this on such a regular basis, I look forward to every Monday when you put out a new episode. I recently started being able to support you guys, and I'm so excited for that because I'd love to see you guys go farther. I hope to hear more in the future. Thank you so much. Bye.
That's great, man.
That is. Thank you very much for the support.
When you say you listen to all the episodes, have you listened to the secret episodes yet?
Oh, the secret episodes?
You know, when you go to restaurants, they have the secret menu.
Sure. You have to ask for it. You have to know about it, and you have to ask for it.
Yes. Well, we have the secret episodes out there. You just got to know where to find them.
Yeah. Gibby's not going to tell you where.
Well, no, it's a secret.
It's a secret. You got to figure it out.
The fact that I even brought it up is probably going to get me kicked out of the secret club.
Well, it's the first rule of Fight Club. You just broke it.
I know.
Don't talk about Fight Club.
But I'm a rebel.
Was Sam Rockwell in Fight Club? I don't think he was.
He would have stole the show, damn it.
He would have done a little dance, too. All right, everyone. That is another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.